one.
The Playhouse. How did I end that last tape? I can't remember now.
Talk about Mr. Nassif.
Oh, yeah, Joe Nassif, he's the head of the drama department at Rollins College in Orlando, Florida. He wrote this dissertation, and it's fairly interesting, but what it is a description of a decline of a community theater. That's essentially what looks like the thread of this. The Playhouse was envisioned by my father and others to be one of the best community theaters in the country, and to rival any others. There were others like the Cleveland Playhouse and the Pasadena Playhouse. And the Playhouse was, for many years, the center of all the activity in Pittsburgh. All the theater actors in Pittsburgh went through those doors. Burley came up with an inventive season of plays, and one of the things that Nassif does in his dissertation is to describe to you, to the reader, all the profits and losses of the year, and so you get some idea of the bottom line of the finances of this organization. And in the beginning, everything was rolling along pretty well. It's difficult to say what really happened to the Playhouse, but different people took over, different choices were made, and gradually, though it continued to prosper, I remember my parents taking me down to the restaurant at the Playhouse when I was a little boy. It was the center of the universe for restaurants in the city. All the baseball players would show up after the game, and the Steelers would show up, and all the arts people would show up, and I would sit there drinking my Shirley Temple, a non-alcoholic drink, and my parents would... My father was very pleased with the whole thing. But gradually... it became obvious to some people that the Playhouse lacked a certain professionalism, supposedly, and that Burley, who was choosing all these plays and directing many of them, was losing his edge. And this took many years for this situation to develop this way. And by the 1960s, 23 years after he had taken over, people were starting to ask these questions. And the history of the Playhouse becomes muddled, confused, and essentially it's a dying theater.
What did the Nixon start?
Oh, well, I don't know. There were two Nixons, of course. There was two Nixon
right.
theaters.
Right.
The first, I remember both of them, and they both were wonderful theaters,
right.
Especially the second one, the old Nixon and the new Nixon. I never understood why they got rid of it. But I don't remember
what
when.
Are
that was the source, by the way, of road companies from New York.
Right, okay, so those were road companies. Isn't there something with actors' equity and with the cost of putting on plays? Isn't that an issue of
well,
what
sure.
you can bring into a smaller theater such as the Playhouse or even today the Public Theater? What are the politics in these things and the finances?
Well, I mean... you have to decide how much money you wish to allocate to a production, and if you have an equity company, obviously you have to pay equity wages. I'm an equity actor, therefore I get maybe $300 a week instead of $50 a week if I'm a non-equity actor. So of course your budget goes up. You have equity stage managers, you have an equity crew. So you need to go into this experience with a good deal of money. The Playhouse didn't have that money, but they did have the support of a very, very strong moneyed board with Mellons and the biggest, most successful. In fact, it's a carbon copy, in some ways, of the Pittsburgh Public Theater's board and supporters, because they all moved over to the professional theater of the Public Theater. Now, Pittsburgh is a very difficult town. It is a very conservative town, and it can't tolerate too many theaters of a professional nature, apparently. But the Playhouse was doing all right as a community theater, semi-professional, because occasionally Burley would bring New York actors into Pittsburgh to be, in fact, in these productions. Many famous people went through the doors of the Playhouse, including Gene Kelly, including George Peppard, including Lisa Kirk.
They were CMU students as well, weren't they?
Yes. Yeah. My mother did a performance with a famous British actress named Flora Robeson in 1943. Mm-hmm. So there were many important people who lent their talents to the Pittsburgh Playhouse. And obviously there was money involved here of a little higher nature. But then when the 60s came along, and of course now television is, you know, 10, 11 years old, tastes are changing, there's more activity, and the Playhouse is competing with everybody else for the buck. But the board, some of the members of the board want a more professional stance, so they fired Burley. And the firing of Burley was probably, in one way, a terrible mistake because it ushered in the decline of the Pittsburgh Playhouse. But, on the other hand, at the very moment that he was fired, they hooked themselves up with Bill Ball, who was at that time an up-and-coming professional director. And his American Conservatory Theater became the theater group that existed at the Playhouse in the summer and fall of 1965. By the fall of 1965, Ball had, his budget had ballooned so much out of proportion that the board got scared and fired him. When he was fired, the board brought in another director named John Hancock, who had been on the West Coast, and he too was very, very into alternative and avant-garde theater. And he proceeded to alienate everybody in Pittsburgh from the very beginning of his stay here in Pittsburgh until he was replaced in the in the winter of 1967. This is a very difficult year. This is all. I think it would be better to read that dissertation. It does give more of a. I'm giving a gloss here of this. But when Hancock was fired, then another group came on. Ron Satloff was then the artistic director. And some people from KDKA Television were then took over the Playhouse. And you see, what happened was there were more and more people in the pot, more and more changes going on. The public became more and more disillusioned, and the Playhouse kept asking for money. At one point, I remember the Playhouse had a $300,000 emergency. I remember my mother waking up one Sunday morning, and a telegram had been slipped under the door. Emergency meeting, we must have, you have to attend. She was then at that time, by the mid-60s, she was now on the board of the Playhouse. And they had to raise the money, and they did. And they raised the money. Once again, they were bailed out. And the public got tired of being bailing out the Pittsburgh Playhouse. By 1968, Point Park College became part of the picture when a proposal was made, partly through Mark Lewis, who was then head of the... he was assistant to the manager of the Playhouse. He proposed a linkage between the Point Park College board and the Playhouse board. So the two of them melded together, and Point Park College then assumed some debts of the Playhouse, took a mortgage out on the building, which supposedly runs out in 2004. It's a 40-year mortgage, or 2008, but I don't know about that. It may be earlier that they retire that mortgage. Anyway, I don't understand that at all. Point Park then became the owner of the building, and the Playhouse was renting it. And then the next 5 years watched the continued erosion of the Pittsburgh Playhouse, with one experiment after another and different people, and Joe Nassif took over in 69 and continued until 1973. He brought in many local Pittsburgh actors, and by 1973 they were in a state of collapse. I was on the board at that point, and I was appointed to the play reading committee and also the film festival. I was supposed to produce a film festival and an ambitious season of 10 plays was announced. One of them was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and the Playhouse had lawsuits coming in every day. No bills were being paid, and there was no money left. It was, and the subscription rate had dwindled to about 1,200. Well, you can't run a theater this way, right. And so you see there was this tremendous deterioration, a loss of faith on the part of many people in Pittsburgh, a desire, a decision, which may or may not have been the right decision, to go professional. Perhaps it could be said that the board was not strong enough to stick it out, but they also saw that Bill Ball, who had taken over in 65 as artistic director, was going to bankrupt the Playhouse if he continued. And some board members, of course, wanted to go back to the good old days when it was a community theater.
When did Frank Blandy decide to leave?
That's a good question. I think it's got to be in the late 60s, mid to late 60s. Because when I began to work at the Playhouse off and on. First I worked there as an assistant to Arthur Manson, who used to run the summer film series. And my job was to do practically nothing. But I was a gopher, you know, running around picking up things and so forth. That was in 68, in the summer of 67. Then in the fall of 68, 69, when Point Park College now had taken over the building, Mark Lewis was then general manager, and I was made film director without the ability to book any films, to pick any films. All I could do was to be there every night, make sure the ushers were there, go around in my car and throw calendars out, you know, distribute them around the city for the film series, and make the calendar up. But I wasn't allowed to actually pick the films. Then, but at that point, I remember that the restaurant was not run by Blandy, so it had to be as early as 1969 that he wasn't there.
So then he moved to?
To
took over the Shenley Theater.
The Shenley Theater, and made it into the, that's another part I don't understand. I mean, obviously it ended up, the Park Shenley ended up on Bigelow Boulevard up on the hill, but before it was down on Forbes Avenue,
the
old Shenley Theater, right. And then from there it went from the Park Shenley and ending up at Lamont, where he, you know, he's still around.
He's very young.
Is he? Okay. Well, I saw him about 2 years ago. He looked pretty old and sick. So, yes, he was the big gun of the Pittsburgh Playhouse restaurant business, as long as that ran. I'm not sure when that restaurant, it must be like 46... 47, his regime would go like 46 to 66 or 67. That seems right. And that restaurant just boomed.
In all fairness, we've got to mention the Devonshire sandwich. That was their baby.
Correct. That was a very famous. Yes, exactly. So the Playhouse, I mean, this is a quickie, condensed history of the Pittsburgh Playhouse. I think that it is very sad that it went out of business. It provided so many people with so much work, and it was like part of the community of Pittsburgh in every way. I mean, for the theater people, all the theater people were involved. But those are different times. It may very well be that the Playhouse should have gone toward a more professional stance. The Burley stuff was getting a little bit too schlock. But the fact of the matter is that my mother started two of his shows in the early 60s, which were two of the biggest hits they ever had, which were commercial hits, I admit, Come Blow Your Horn and Bye Bye Birdie, Neil Simon. You know, it is possible that some of the board members felt that the time had come. Now, this renegade members of the board who quit after Ball was fired became the impetus for the Pittsburgh Public Theater. They didn't, in fact, have the exact impetus, because Joan Apt and Margaret Rick were the ones who really did that. But they are the ones who helped to, they were out there pushing for a professional theater. If the Playhouse wasn't going to do it, then somebody else had to do it.
And how did the Rockwells get in there?
That's another good question. Somehow or other, in 1984, they donated some money and got their name on the Rockwell, on the Craft Avenue Theater, and made it the Rockwell Theater. I don't know. I really don't know.
Okay, just for the tape's sake, let's move the Tree of Life Synagogue to where it is now. Move to Wilkins Avenue.
Wilkins Avenue, yeah.
And Shady.
Ma'am?
Oh, certainly.
The Roswell Theater was always a theater? It was built to be a theater?
Let me clarify this. The Rockwell Theater, which used to be the Kraft Avenue Theater, was in fact a synagogue, and was the congregation synagogue.
Okay, and what was the end? You said there was a hallway.
That was the Tree of Life. But the Playhouse connected themselves to the play, to the old synagogue. In fact, one day I went. I have pictures of the inside of that synagogue. And so I brought them down to the Playhouse, and they hung them there for about 6 months, and someone stole them. But the fact is, I have the negatives, so I can do whatever I want. I can have that made again. I can turn them out, and they can keep stealing them all they want.
All right. Do you want to continue? I can go on and on. You have to make do all the work here.
Well,
you want to finish this tape?
I have
how
a
do you
question.
Feel?
When you, how do you go about booking films? I mean.
Oh, the film business.
Yeah.
The film process. Well, I ran the film series at the Playhouse for 15 years. And what you really essentially do is you have to know what film companies distribute what films. And you simply get on the phone and yell and scream if you have to, or make deals with these film companies for films. Now, the stuff that I was doing last summer at the Pittsburgh Cultural Trust at the Byam Theater downtown was easier. It was old movies, like The Philadelphia Story, like Lolita, Monty Python and the Holy Grail, My Fair Lady. What you do is you get on the phone and you say, this is what we are, and we usually accept deals at 35% of the gross of the theater, and they usually agree to that. Some distributors get greedy and they want upfront, it's called upfront money, meaning you have to pay $150 before you get the film. Also, many companies insist that you pay for all the shipping, and it comes from all over the country. So I have to coordinate 10 and 12 film companies with all these films shipped in all over the country. And again, it's like Grand Central Station, and I have to keep doing that. And so the business of booking the films is rather relatively easy. You just have to know who you have to talk to. Sometimes I don't know. For example, I want to do some Charlie Chaplin this summer. And I found out that the company that it used to distribute it doesn't do it anymore, and there's a company in New York State that has it now, a little tiny company. And that's good news, but I sometimes have to dig around for this stuff. Some, but I have it in my head. I'm like a computer. I don't have a computer, but I know. But I also have tons of pieces of paper with all kinds of stuff on it. And I make sure that I read Variety and know exactly who has what film. For instance, I'm going to be showing a film called Ponette, which is a wonderful movie. And last summer, this summer coming up, hopefully. It's a great film. But I don't know at this moment until I go home and look at it. I think it's Miramax, I'll just guess. But I will call them on the phone. I know the guy at Miramax. And I'll say, I want this film for one night. And he'll say, okay, here's the price. If I wanted it for two nights, it would be the same price. It usually. So that's generally how that works. And the rest is up to my ability to predict what the public wants to see. And that's what I've been doing.
Thank you.
Sure.
I realize that the quality of a film is totally far superior to a what we know's video. How do you, you go to Blockbuster and just rent some and show a video?
No.
You can't do that. Why?
Well, I mean, we have a movie screen and we have two gigantic, what are called 35mm projectors.
Okay.
And they just show the pictures on the screen, and the sound at the Byam is very good. We've got stereo, surround sound, Dolby sound, is what it's called. And it's a fabulous surrounding to watch movies. And to watch a film on a large screen is far superior to watching it even on, I have a 27-inch television set, and that's nothing. I mean, it seems like it's still a small set now. I've been watching it for 3 years. Yeah, there's no comparison. I watched the Philadelphia Story with Katharine Hepburn and Cary Grant and Jimmy Stewart last summer, and it was like amazing. You're seeing huge images of people that you know about, and it's just beautiful.
So you're a devotee of film and American.
Well, especially, and certainly not television.
How do you feel about all this coloring?
Absolutely not. I reject it absolutely, totally. I will not buy a colorized version of anything, and there'll be no colorized versions of movies because it's just meaningless. They're guessing. They're guessing what someone looks like in 1935, and that may be right, but it may not be right. And there are many reasons for not doing that. I've seen colorized versions of. I saw Now Voyager with Betty Davis. It just doesn't make any difference. I don't care if she may have a blue dress, but she may not have. It may have been a brown dress, and I don't like that.
Don't
specify.
Like family.
Oh, you mean the guy? The
gave the money.
They gave the money, and that's why their name is on the Bayham Theater. It used to be called the Fulton Theater, and before that, by the way, when you go into the theater, look down on the floor as you walk in, and there in the flooring of the theater is the Gaiety Theater, which is the original name.
Was it a burlesque?
Yes. G-A-Y-E-T-Y. I mean, not a burlesque house, that may be. But it was, like all other theaters in Pittsburgh at the turn of the century, road shows came in here from New York.
J.P. Harris brought all that.
J.P. Harris, but the Gaiety is one of the big ones, and the Alvin, and all, they're all gone, obviously. But the name, being in the floor, and you can see it, it's cracking. But it's still there. It's wonderful. I wish the theater had been called the Gaiety, but $3 or $4 million had something to say about that, so that's why.
Want to talk about the O'Reilly Theater?
The O'Reilly Theater is the Pittsburgh Public Theater. The former will be the former Pittsburgh Public Theater, and Mr. O'Reilly's wife, he is the CEO of the Heinz Company. I think his wife and he gave the money for that. So it's the O'Reilly Theater.
And then your mother's?
And then my mother, I gave some money, not as much, to get the Helen Wayne Rao Rehearsal Hall on the third floor. You could buy all kinds of things. I chose that.
Okay, I'm going to go over a few things that we made notes on. And you mentioned George S. Kaufman, and I asked you earlier, that was part of the Algonquin Roundtable, right?
Yes.
Do you remember all the people or some of the people?
Dorothy Parker, Alexander Wolcott, Harold Ross, who was the head of the New Yorker. Excuse me, thank you. I hear a voice. Robert Benchley.
Was Harpo Marx one of them?
I doubt it, but may have been invited. Mm-hmm. Or Groucho. You know, it was an expanding thing, but there was a hardcore. Let's see, Alexander Wolcott and H. Oh, I don't know. I'm pretty sure.
All right. Now, you mentioned. Oh, who is Elizabeth in Toronto?
Oh, Elizabeth Plaut. She is Plaut. She is a cousin of mine in some distant way, and she wrote that book about the Guggenheims and the worms.
Oh, great. Okay, then. Who was Uncle Bert? We've already covered.
She's my grandmother's brother.
Yeah, we mentioned that. We did that. You've covered a lot. Willoughby Jacobs.
Willoughby Jacobs. He was the owner of Bankers Lithographing Company. My father joined in 1932 as the second partner, and the third partner died immediately afterwards, so he became a joint partner. Well, kind of vice president.
Okay. There was also the cartoonist. We talked about your grandfather was in a caricature or what do you call a political satire?
Oh, well, in fact, I was trying to find the actual, I saved this, but I can't find it, it's stored.
Sitting on a fence.
He was supposedly a great fence sitter, and he was criticized for this, and there's a big editorial in this newspaper, a Pittsburgh paper, calling him Enoch Rao Baker. It's with big, huge black letters.
And you don't know who the
I don't know what to...
Okay, Hillman Leiby. Unless you have more questions, I'd like to turn the tape recorder off and ask a few questions, and maybe we can do some cleaning up the next time. Okay? Okay, Gabby Dinman just asked if Richard, what he knew, and if he knew Richard, Don Brockett, so that's what we're going to do now.
Yeah, I just, briefly, about Don Brockett. He was a wonderful performer here in the Pittsburgh area. He died 2 years ago. But my mother and he were very good friends during his life and her life, and she performed in several of his revues. For example, when Ben Gross's used to exist out on Route 30, she performed in a series of sketches, and at that time Pete Flaherty was the mayor of Pittsburgh, and she was in a sketch called the Flaherty Family Singers, and they all came out in short little skirts and did these goofy things. She also did Mae West for him.
I saw that.
And then one time she told me she went to New York City. I remember this, but I didn't know much about it, and did a Calgon bubble bath commercial, not in a bathtub, but for a bunch of business executives of the Calgon Corporation. He did a lot of those industrials in New York and other places. One time she did a show for him at Rabbit Run, Ohio, and complained that he wouldn't pay her the $35 that she was owed. And she said, I don't like to work for nothing. And he did have a problem with paying actors on time, she said to me. So I don't really know. But I knew that every year at my Christmas, we went to his house for Christmas party. And his wife, Leslie, is very gracious. And she set up a Brockett scholarship. And he was a very, very strong influence in the Pittsburgh area and employed so many local talent, so many local talented people, that it's just beyond the number. And he every year did a Forbidden Pittsburgh comedy show, which has not been revived recently, and very funny, particularly topical. And my last image of him, the last one he did, was his playing Sophie Maslov in drag and talking like her and so forth, and it was very funny. A lot of people didn't like him because he was so excessive, but I think he made his mark in Pittsburgh, and he was very happy about what he was doing. And my mother was very much of a supporter of his, to the extent that even in the 1970s, I at one time dabbled in investments on Broadway in shows, because my father's closest friend, Eddie Spector, who was the manager of the symphony in the 1930s, became a Broadway producer. And so I and my mother would funnel money into Eddie's shows, and very few of them were big hits, except that one of them actually was a hit, Look Home and Angel, based on Thomas Wolfe's novel. And he also did a play called Any Wednesday. Mm. And a play called, which nobody has heard of, called First Impressions, which was a musical version of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, and then did a play, which I like, called Henry, Sweet Henry in 1967, and I went to New York with my mother to see this show. But Eddie was a big theater supporter, and... Eddie was a big theater supporter, and... but my real reason for this longer... kind of association was that my mother and I decided to invest in a Brockett production called Sweet Feet, because the drama critic of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, who at that time was still alive, George Anderson, had made a big deal out of it. And I went out to Ben Gross's to see this show with my mother, and at the end of the show I said to her, I don't think this is such a good show, and she said, you have to give money to this show to show support for Don Brockett. And although I don't think Eddie was the producer of this. Anyway, we put money into it, and it bombed on the first night of the production. And it was the first time in history that I know of that the reviewers actually criticized the manager of the theater for booking it, actually putting it into the space. And you know, the New York critics were pretty vicious about this show, and we never, of course, I got a tax deduction for that year, but I always remembered that. It was not a good, but Brock had always jumped, you know, bounced back, and he did other kinds of material. It didn't bother him that this didn't work out, and he was still very strong and continued working with his industrial shows in the New York City area and elsewhere. And he would take many performers, you know, in Pittsburgh, out there. So that was that's the connection between my mother and Brockett, and it was a pretty strong